This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Let's look at the impossible. What would happen to New York City if a reactor or two at Indian Point suffered a catastrophic meltdown?
It would have to be evacuated permanently. And what I realized is that it's not the terrorists that's the danger here. It's the actual old, corroded machinery at Indian Point.
You just can't make this stuff up. The hub of world financial activity, Wall Street and all, is gambling every day the two old reactors just 25 miles away won't finally melt down Fukushima style. Even the Nuclear Regulatory Commission thinks Indian Point has the most at risk for an earthquake reactors in the country. Later in this program, we'll talk with environmental lawyer, activist, and local resident Susan Hito Shapiro about the real threat. But first, I found another jaw-dropping, gasp-for-breath story in climate science. Is 2 degrees centigrade of warming safe? What about 17 or 20 degrees hotter? That's right. The United Nations Panel on Climate Change doesn't tell you the ultimate destination, where we're going. When our current emissions at 400 parts per million finally stabilizes, London will be a tropical swamp with hippos and crocodiles. Again. I've been on the climate watch since 1990. How come nobody told us this? And our source is not a blogger from Nowheristan. He's a scientist with decades of experience and a who's who's list of scientific connections. The only good news is there is some good news. He can also see a way to bring the world's climate back to the place we recognize and survive. It's all in a day's work at Radio EcoShock. Are we heading towards a supertropical planet with today's coastlines deep underwater? We're going to talk about what the United Nations may not tell you and the best way to save what's left. Our guest is Dr. Thomas J. Goreau. He's studied planetary physics and astronomy before getting his doctorate in biogeochemistry at Harvard. Born in Jamaica, among many fields of expertise, Thomas Goreau is an expert in coral reef science. He is president of the Global Coral Reef Alliance. But I've asked Dr. Goreau to join us because of a startling speech he made last November at Tufts University. The conference was called Biodiversity for a Livable Climate. Thomas Goreau, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi there. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, and it's a pleasure to have you here. I'm looking forward to talking with you. Now, about 25 years ago, you predicted Earth's climate could get 20 degrees centigrade hotter. That's way, way beyond the 2 or 4 degrees being talked about by many scientists, the ones working with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, for example. Could you explain that prediction and why your estimates are so much higher than the official line we hear?
Yeah, sure. I'm delighted to, because it's an odd situation, because what we run into is people denying that any climate change is happening and saying that the Intergovernmental Panel climate change projections for the future must be exaggerations. So the whole criticism that we get from them is that they are too large by people who basically don't want to have to deal with the implications of those changes. And what I'm saying is precisely the opposite. I'm saying that IPCC has greatly underestimated what the long-term impacts will be. The key phrase there is long-term. That's really key, because IPCC was created by the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change as an advisory board to provide information to governments on a couple things. Basically, what the science had to say about climate change, whether it was real, how fast it's taking place, and so forth and so on. And also to provide model-based estimates on what would happen in the future for various scenarios, such as business as usual and so forth and so on. So they were asked to create model-based scenarios, and that's what the IPCC reports were. They said, you know, if CO2 rises, the very first IPCC report in 1990 discussed this, what would happen if CO2 doubled. From, say, at that point, it was closer to 350 ppm or something than it is now, 400. But if that doubled, say, to 700, and then how much temperature would rise? And they said it might rise about, you know, 1 to 2 to 3 degrees centigrade. And sea level rise, they said, might be about 10 centimeters or 50 centimeters or so. So and that, those stuck in people's minds as the predictions they were making from the models they had. But what they didn't really tell you is when that would happen. And the thing is, IPCC was mandated by governments to give model-based predictions for what would happen in 10, 20, 50, maybe 100 years at the outside, okay? And the thing is this, is that when the Earth warms up, that heat gets absorbed by the ocean. The ocean holds more than 95% of the heat in the system. The atmosphere, the rocks, the vegetation, all that, the ground holds very little. It's the ocean that holds most of that heat. And so that the ocean is slowly heating up. Until the whole ocean warms up, we won't feel the full effect of warming at the surface. And the fact is that almost all the ocean is cold. It's cold because water at the North Pole and the South Pole have been in contact with the ice, and they've gotten very cold, and that makes them dense, and they sink to the bottom. And so the whole deep sea has been filled up with chilled ice water from the ice caps at the poles. And until that warms up, we won't feel the full effect at the surface. It takes 1,000 years for the ocean to turn over. And so until the deep sea warms up, we won't feel that effect at the surface, the full effect. It's sort of like what happens if you have a house in colder part of Canada than British Columbia, and if you've got your fireplace, you know, and your furnace at full blast downstairs, and you've got all your attic windows open, or your upstairs windows open, what's going to happen is all that heat's going to rush upstairs. Until upstairs warms up, you won't feel warm downstairs. Well, the Earth's sort of built upside, the ocean's built upside down in that sense, because the warm stuff's on top and the cold stuff's on the bottom, but the same principle applies. So until the deep sea warms up, we won't feel the full effect of the surface, and that takes 1,000 years. So there's a built-in time delay in the system. So when you increase CO2 today, the full effect takes 1,000 years to be felt. These models only went to 10, 20, 50, or 100 years. That's one-tenth of the time it takes to reach the steady state. So what I did is I did something completely different. I looked at what the actual long-term climate record had to say about long-term changes in temperature and sea level and CO2, which are recorded in Antarctic ice cores, are recorded in old fossil corals, they're recorded in deep-sea cores that have been accurately dated. So we can look at those histories in detail and see how things really changed in the past. And we've got 1 million years of records. Now, when the first IPCC report came out, we didn't have 1 million years of climate high-resolution CO2 ice core data. We only had about 200,000 years at that point. But I looked at that data, and I looked at how temperature, CO2, temperature and sea level and CO2 changed together, and I was able to determine what the sensitivity of the real system was and compare that to the sensitivity in the IPCC models. And what I found was that they're just way too low. And the real reason is the political mandate. The political mandate was essentially to ignore 90% or more of the response. That's not telling you, the IPCC projections are not telling you where we're going to go ultimately. They're telling you where we're going to go at some small intermediate portion of that way. But we have a long hill to climb after that point. It's a very important metaphorical error because the governments somehow think when IPCC says it'll rise to 2 degrees C for some given amount of, when they say that's an acceptable warming, they don't really understand that that 2 degrees is not where we're going to get. That's just 2 degrees in, say, 50 years, but then another 2 degrees in another 50 years, et cetera, et cetera. It's a constantly rising ramp. It's not an end point. And I think if we're serious about protecting our planet or our life support systems, we really need to look at the long-term impacts of what our activities now are going to do in the future. And the problem is that those extend way, way beyond the IPCC projections. The temperature is the shortest part of it, the 1,000-year time lag. The rise in sea level is probably more like 5,000 years or more. In fact, it's more than that because it's going to take at least 5,000 years probably to melt the glacial ice caps. And until all that goes, we won't feel the full effect of sea level rise. It's not going to be slow and constant, but that time lag is at least 5,000 years and maybe more.
All right, but what if we run out of fossil fuels in the next 100 or 150 years? We burn most of what we've got, and then we get a little smarter. We stop using the last bits in the ground. Won't that solve the problem?
Well, no amount of the problem is that we're already above what's acceptable. This is the real issue. You see, right now we're at 400 parts per million CO2. Now, if we look at how the climate system has behaved, what the long-term steady state value is, that's what I say. Based now on a million years of climate data, we can say that before 100 ppm, the long-term increase in temperature is going to be about 17 degrees centigrade, not one or two that people are worrying about. And the long-term rise in sea level is going to be about 23 meters, or about 75 feet, not the 50 centimeters or so that people are freaked out about right now.
17 degrees C, that's you know, around 30-something degrees Fahrenheit warmer. That sounds like extinction-level, runaway, global warming. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, it absolutely is. You see, now let me take you and give you another example, okay? I come from the island of Jamaica, as you mentioned. In Jamaica, we happen to have perfectly preserved, on the north coast of Jamaica, the ancient sea level, the caves that lie right at the ancient sea level from the last time in Earth history when it was 2 degrees C warmer than today, which is what the UNFCCC has said is an acceptable level of climate change. They say beyond 2 degrees C it gets dangerous, but 2 degrees is okay. Okay, that's the premise they're operating under. So now let's go back and look at how the Earth really was the last time it was 2 degrees C warmer than today. And that was about 125,000 years ago. It was the last interglacial period, the last warm period before the last set of ice ages. At that point, these fossil sea level caves in Jamaica are about 7 meters above today's sea level. Okay, and in front of them lies the ancient fossil reef that formed before them at that time about 125,000 years ago. And that reef is, you know, a magnificent fossil reef. Boy, I used to climb all up and down it. And the lower part of that has all the corals in the position in which they grew. I recognize every different species if you know your corals, which I do. And then up above it, there's a 1 centimeter thick red clay band. And there's a red clay layer. And then above that, all the corals are broken and lying on their sides. They've been completely crushed, lying broken. What we now are realizing is that that last time it was 2 degrees C warmer than today, pretty much all the coral reefs in the tropics are thought to have died because the temperature was beyond what they could take. That those corals had died, been broken by storms, and were unable to keep growing. That's why they seemed to be broken. It was too hot for corals to survive. It was beyond the limit of what they could tolerate. Now, at that same time, when it was 7 meters higher than sea level than today, it was 2 degrees C warmer, London, England had hippopotamuses and crocodiles. Okay, their fossils are in the British Museum. So, you know, 2 degrees C warmer made London, England into a subtropical swamp habitat. That's 2 degrees C warmer, 7 meters higher. And at that time, CO2 was about 270 parts per million. We're at 400 right now. Okay, so if people say 2 degrees C is warmer is acceptable, the long-term implications of that are 7 meters higher sea level rise and London, England being underwater or being a swamp.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Dr. Thomas Goreau on our program, and as you can hear, things are more serious than we've been told, but you also do have a solution. So how could we stop this catastrophe from happening?
Well, thanks. That's exactly the point, is that first, it's far worse than people recognize, and the second important point is we know how to solve the problem. We're just not using what we know. And that is that the following is that, you see, when people talk about CO2 in the atmosphere, they're fixated on the fossil fuels we're adding. And as you pointed out, we're going to burn them all at the rate we're going in about 100 to 200 years. You know, we'll exhaust all the coal and oil and put it into the atmosphere. We should increase the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere many times higher than it is now. But there's a limit to how far it can go when all that stuff is gone. It'll take, you know, a couple million years for that CO2 to work its way out of the atmosphere and out of the system, ultimately, and get buried. But the point you've got to realize is what controls the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere isn't fossil fuels. It's two things. It's the biology of forests on land. The plants are sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere in photosynthesis. They're making living biomass out of that. And then they die and break down, or they're what's called respiration. They breathe it out just like we do. They breathe off CO2. And so there's this huge cycle, very fast cycle of CO2 going through the living biomass on land, and there's an equivalent cycle in the ocean where the CO2 gets mixed by winds into the surface ocean, gets taken up by the marine plants, and so forth and so on. So the rate at which those cycles are going is really what controls the amount of CO2 into the atmosphere. Now, when we talk about reducing fossil fuel emissions, which we've got to do, it can't possibly, all that can do is reduce the rate at which further CO2 increase happens. Only reduce it. We can only capture a very small amount, and all the proposals people have for capturing carbon and storing it cost at least $450 per ton and aren't affordable, even if they're technically feasible, which they mostly aren't. So it's a serious issue with those. But the point is, even if all that worked, even if you believed that there was cost-effective and technically feasible, which I don't think it is, then all it could do is slightly slow the increase. And what we need to do is we need to reduce CO2, because a safe level of CO2 is something else we can determine. I use those long-term climate data to say, well, what is the level of CO2 that corresponds to today's temperature for no significant change? And what that is, that's 260 ppm, which is less than what it was at that ancient fossil sea level in Jamaica. So it means we've got to remove 140 ppm from the atmosphere. Fossil fuel emissions reductions can't do that. We have to find a way to remove that. And the way to do that is not to try to pump it underground and use big pumps or, you know, the technical fixes. It's to simply harvest nature. It's to make the trees grow faster, plant trees, grow biomass. Let the plants suck up that excess CO2 out of the atmosphere. And they're capable of doing that quite quickly because they cycle the CO2 from the atmosphere through the vegetation about once every 6 years. Now, the problem is it decomposes and goes back to the atmosphere. And the way we manage vegetation, the way we manage the carbon in the soil, and that's the elephant in the room, is six times more carbon in the soil than there is in either the atmosphere or vegetation. But it's not included in the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. No one has to account for it. Now, if we increase the amount of carbon in the soil by only 10% or so, we could absorb all the excess CO2 and stabilize CO2 at safe levels. That could be done in as little as a few decades if we harvested photosynthesis instead of letting the plants decompose, is converted them into organic carbon in soil, or what's called biochar, like charcoal, but instead of burning it, you bury it in the ground where it absorbs water, it absorbs nutrients, makes the soil more fertile, it removes CO2 from the atmosphere and puts it back in the ground where it's safe. And it can last basically forever. At the same time, it solves our agricultural and forest fertility problems and solves our water supply problems, too, because it retains water in the soil. So there are ways to do that. And there's an even further benefit from that, is that the way to convert biomass into what's called biochar, which was invented by Amazonian Indians somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 years ago. They made black soils all along the Amazon that are, you know, anywhere from 10 to 50% charcoal by weight. They're the richest soils in the world, incredibly fertile. Now, if we were to adapt their technology, we can make the charcoal from vegetation, but we can also trap the energy, which they couldn't do. You see, now we can use all of that energy for heat. We can use it to make electricity. And we can also trap the volatile materials that they couldn't get, the gases and the liquids, the vapors that come off. And so you can also make things like natural gases that you could burn as fuel. You can make liquid fuels that can replace petroleum. And so, mind you, when you burn that, you're putting some CO2 back into the atmosphere. But because that CO2 was removed by plants, it's recycled. It's not CO2. The beauty of it is that for every gram of CO2 that you're recycling, you're burying more in the ground. So the net effect is to reduce CO2. So that's actually carbon-negative sustainable energy. It's possible to replace coal and oil and petroleum with that and to reduce CO2 at the same time.
Can we do that on a large enough scale to really make this happen? I'm having a hard time picturing how this would progress.
Well, I think that's possible. I've just published a book on soil fertility restoration, carbon sequestration. And it's a 600-page book with 34 chapters. And we've got results of people all over the world, in every continent except Antarctica, that have, you know, developed methods for increasing recycling and increasing soil fertility. There are many different methods that can be used, about half a dozen very different methods. And the point is that the people who are trying to restore their own habitat, some case their own backyard or their own farm or their own vegetable garden, the ones who are good at it have really enriched their soil and carbon. They've made what are barren lands very fertile. And millions of people have done this. This is the really interesting thing. They've done it all over the world. There are people who've figured out how to solve their own immediate problem for their own private ends. But the point is, if we were using these kinds of best practices, we could be building carbon in the soil and solving global warming at the same time. So the problem is that although millions of people are doing the right thing, there are billions who are doing the wrong thing, because most of our conventional farming and land management is based on cutting down the vegetation, burning it, and then treating the soil in a way that causes the organic carbon that was there to break down. We've lost half the carbon that used to be in our soils in all our agricultural land. And if we put it back, we can enrich the land and solve global warming at the same time. In fact, it's really our only hope if we want to try to prevent coral reefs from going extinct, because coral reefs can't take any more warming. They can't take 2 degrees. We're at the limit already with coral reefs.
And what happens if we lose the coral reefs?
Well, for over 100 countries, coral reefs are their major marine resource. In economic terms, their food comes from it. Their fisheries is almost entirely from coral reefs. Their economies are almost entirely based on tourism. The tourism is based on the white sands. The white sands, every grain of sand came from the coral reef. It was only there because not only a coral reef produces sand, but the reef itself is a growing, living protection. Without the coral reefs, those islands wouldn't be there, the low-lying islands or many, you know. So for over 100 countries, it's their major source of, you know, economic revenues from fisheries, from tourism, it provides their shore protection. It has most of their biodiversity. It's their most beautiful system. So it's a huge economic resource for half of all the countries in the world. If they lose that, then you ask, well, how do you replace that? Well, you know, and then you've got to import food because you don't have fish. Your beaches are gone, so you have no tourists. Your islands are washing away. You know, they're going to lose everything. The low-lying islands are going to lose absolutely everything when they lose their reefs. And the thing is, they've lost most of them. For example, you know, I developed the method for predicting coral bleaching from satellite data. It's caused by high temperatures. Began in the 80s, it's getting worse and worse. Until this year, every single coral reef region in the world that had catastrophic or severe mortality of corals due to high temperature, so it'd be getting too hot for them to survive, every region of the world except only one area in the Central Pacific. That was the only area that had been lucky so far. Well, this year they were hit. This year they were hit. And this year, in the areas where we have reports, 3/4 of the corals died very quickly from high temperatures. So, you know, they can't take any more warming.
Now, as we wrap up, what do you think the next climate summit in Paris needs to do to get real about solving climate change?
Well, they're running away from both the magnitude of the problem and the solutions. And the real tragedy is that the one place we can solve the problem is in the soil. And soil is not included in the Framework Convention on Climate Change. Countries are not mandated to account for it. They're not mandated to increase their soil carbon. So what's needed is that countries modify the UNFCC so it makes scientific sense. It has complete accounting of all greenhouse gas sources and sinks and all the things that are important for affecting CO2, which soil is just a crucial emission. It's just been ignored. So the result is you can't get carbon credits for putting carbon in the soil, even though it's the only thing that can solve the problem. So they have to, one, recognize soil as a carbon sink, require that it be monitored, and then fund projects through the UN Development and Agricultural and Forestry agencies, help fund projects all over the world by all methods in every location, you know, by people who are increasing their soil carbon. You've got to account for it. I mean, really, in the long run, we really have to reward people who are solving the problem. I mean, the farmers and the foresters and the people who are enriching their soil, we've got to reward them because of what they're doing to prevent what's going to happen to us if they don't. But right now, there's no carbon accounting for soil. Until there is, we can't do it in a rational way.
You've suggested that the carbon tax, instead of being sent back to the people or used by the government, should go to carbon farmers, essentially.
No, absolutely. The point is that the tax should go to directly solving the problem. But everyone's looking at it as a political giveaway. I mean, the politicians are salivating at the notion that this is money that they can spend on political giveaways to get reelected. But the point is that won't solve the problem. First and foremost, I mean, I don't really care if the politicians want to erect stadiums named after more dead politicians, you know, with the money. But they can only do that after they first solve the problem. So the first issue is that really the polluter pays, the person who puts CO2 into the atmosphere should pay whatever it really costs to remove it. That's not really that much. If you do it right, it really isn't that much. If it becomes a political giveaway, then it becomes expensive, it becomes inflationary, and it doesn't solve the problem. Well, we can't afford to let the politicians monkey around with this. It's just too important for that.
We've been speaking with Dr. Thomas J. Goreau. He's struggled against the rising tide of carbon pollution and dying coral for decades, and he's made a lot of scientific friends along the way. Find out more at globalcoral.org. I'll put a link to Dr. Goreau's startling presentation at Tufts University in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. You can watch it on YouTube as well. Thomas, thank you so much for helping us out.
Well, thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be on.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. Let's go over a few main points from that interview, since you probably haven't heard that news before and may not hear it again for a while. I'm not a scientist. This is just what I found in Google searches, and you can do that for yourself. The actual climate record says the world will keep warming for thousands of years. At our current level of 400 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it may settle out between 17 degrees and 20 degrees C warmer, at least 30 degrees hotter in Fahrenheit. That's the global mean. The seas will be at least 27 feet higher, maybe 70 feet higher. And back in the last great warming period, the Eemian, most of the world's coral reefs died, sea levels were super high, and the CO2 levels in the atmosphere were only 280 parts per million, much lower than today. I found that hard to believe, so I went back into the charts myself. Has the Earth ever been that hot? So we won't count the very early days of the planet or the time when a collision split off the moon. NASA estimates temperatures in the atmosphere may have hit 3,600 degrees Fahrenheit. There was no life then. In days of living things, Earth was at least 5 to 8 degrees C or 13 degrees hotter in Fahrenheit than today, reaching 73 degrees mean temperature versus our 60 degree Fahrenheit global average today. That was the Paleo-Eocene Thermal Maximum, or PETM, around 55 million years ago. There was no ice on Earth, but palm trees and crocodiles around the Arctic Sea. Many species went extinct. There are two striking points about the United Nations approach to climate change coming out of this interview with Thomas Goreau. First, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has been blinkered to look at just the next 100 years at most. We've all become conditioned to that, sure, without asking what happens in the next 100 years or 500 years. Yes, we'll all be dead by then, but think back. If people in medieval Europe developed this fossil-fueled civilization, right about now we'd all be struggling to avoid extinction, living on mountaintops or in the Arctic. Most of our animal and plant friends, including our food, would have been long gone. That's what we apparently agreed to leave our descendants. The second big point about the UN climate framework is they don't count carbon soil at all. They don't measure it. Nobody rewards people who can put carbon back in the soil. They're sure big on closing some plant that never existed in China to avoid some emissions. But what about the soil? What about our farmers? Our whole effort is not agricultural. It's industrial. Of course, we're industrial folks. Let's cut back carbon emissions, close the coal mines and the tar sands. Well, that won't stabilize the Earth's climate at all. It just makes our future less worse and stalls the big change 100 or 200 years. That's worth it, but it's not enough. I know plenty of so-called realists who blast Bill McKibben's 350.org for being so whimsical, demanding we go backwards in carbon emissions time. It's obvious carbon emissions in the atmosphere are going up, 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 except that does mean we're doomed and our world with it. Thomas Goreau is part of a growing chorus of scientists and activists who expose the awful truth. Even 350 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere is too high. We need to wind back the carbon clock way back to about 260 parts per million. I've just had an interesting email conversation with Albert Bates. He's the counterculture thinker from The Farm in Tennessee. Albert's really into dirt and getting carbon back into it. He's off teaching the ways of permaculture and carbon farming, this time in Belize. Some of his most ardent students, and maybe our best hope, come from South America, where the whole idea of biochar originated some 5,000 years ago. He tells me some big names are getting interested in soil carbon solutions. Expect to hear more about that. And if you don't, our great-grandkids may be cooked. I'm Alex Smith. We'll be right back with another way the world financial system can melt down just like Fukushima.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. A few weeks ago, I talked with clean investor Dan Miller. After our chat, Dan said something along the lines of, "You know, Alex, if you really, really understood the total climate threat and the deadline, you might rethink your opposition to nuclear power." I get about a half dozen emails like that a week. Maybe. Maybe if some Bill Gatesian creature could finally come out with an underground thorium reactor that was self-healing, couldn't possibly blow up, couldn't leak nuclear waste, maybe I could live with that if it ever comes. But I sure can't live with the mass insanity that passes for nuclear power right now. Listen to this. Today and every day, tens of millions of Americans in and around New York City risk a Fukushima-style meltdown of two nearby reactors. The Indian Point Energy Center is just 38 miles north of New York City. Those old reactors have leaks, fires, and shutdowns galore. The reactors are very close to a known earthquake fault. And for all this and much more, Indian Point could be America's most dangerous nuclear plant. Now, the triple meltdown at Fukushima in Japan taught us that a nuclear accident is not a local issue. If you live in the Northern Hemisphere or anywhere near an ocean, this is your problem. This is your story. Radio EcoShock investigates with longtime nuclear activist and New York State environmental lawyer Susan Hito Shapiro. Susan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi. A couple of things. Can I just clarify a couple of things that you stated that are actually make it worse than what you said?
All right.
We actually have 20 million people that are in the Indian Point reactor community. That means 20 million people live within 50 miles of Indian Point, and that includes New York City and one of the U.S. mints and, you know, the entire financial markets and everything. And also, Indian Point is only 25 miles, not 38 miles, from Times Square.
Wow.
And, yeah, it's much closer. And it's located on three intersecting earthquake faults. So there are three intersecting earthquake fault lines that Indian Point is right on top of, basically. And the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, has actually acknowledged that Indian Point is the number one plant in the nation at risk for damage from an earthquake.
Well, I want to ask you more about that in just a second. But first of all, a couple of quick questions. Do you live near the Indian Point reactor complex?
I used to live very close, and now I move further away because of it, but I still work within 11 miles of it, and my father lives within 9 miles of it, and I grew up there. And because I became more knowledgeable, I moved further away, but I'm still within 30 miles.
And could you describe the site a bit for us, for those who don't know? How many reactors are at Indian Point? Who owns them?
Okay, there are two working reactors at Indian Point, but the original Indian Point 1 was shut down but not decommissioned because they still use parts of Number 1, which is one of the first reactors in the country to operate. And it's owned by Entergy, which is a Louisiana-based corporation, and they've basically spun off these small little corporations, so they're shell corporations that currently own Indian Point.
Now, you've raised this earthquake question, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, as you said, just turned down an attempt by the reactor operator to avoid doing proper quake risk studies. What just happened in December?
Right. The NRC, after Fukushima, did a lessons learned evaluation, and they said, well, you know, they looked at Indian Point as the number one plant in the nation at risk for earthquake fault damage because it wasn't designed for earthquakes. And at that time, they only knew of one fault line running underneath it, but the seismology science has advanced, and now they know that there are three intersecting active fault lines under Indian Point, and it's a very brittle area because it's all bedrock. So an earthquake here is a real jarring experience. It's not like on sand, which, yes, it would be horrible and everything would move, but here on bedrock, things crack. And it's a very fragile kind of situation. So what happened was the NRC said you have to do these studies and these evaluations because Indian Point right now is in the process of getting a new 20-year license. They call it relicensing, but in actuality it's a new license. And that's why they've ordered this. And Entergy tried to, you know, get out of it. And miraculously, actually, the NRC said, no, you actually have to do the study and get it done on time. Normally, the NRC has granted Entergy every request for exemptions from any kind of safety standards that they've ever asked. So this was a real, you know, game changer in that sense that they said, no, you actually have to do this study.
Yeah, the NRC, it's amazingly slow to protect the public. I read about this, and Entergy has until 2017 to come up with a plan against a quake, and then more years to implement whatever hardening is needed, if they ever do. They always drag their feet. So what happens if nature doesn't follow that schedule and a quake comes sooner?
Well, it's a really big issue. I'll tell you a couple of the other really frightening aspects of Indian Point. You have two natural gas pipelines that run within 500 feet of Indian Point 3. And at Indian Point 3, what the NRC in their infinite wisdom did was they granted Entergy an exemption from fire safety protection standards. And we've been litigating this since 2007. It's still going around and around the litigation cycle. But what basically happened was that the NRC granted approval to use a fire insulating wrap, like we would consider it, you know, insulation in our walls or something, a fire safety. And it's supposed to have a rating of at least, it was originally 3 hours. They said, no, we'll exempt it down to 1 hour. And then it turned out when they actually finally tested the material called HEMYC, it's HEMYC, it's an insulating material, and Congress finally made them test it after 15 years, they found out that HEMYC doesn't work for an hour. It only works for 24 minutes. So the NRC said to Entergy alone at Indian Point, not to any other plant in the country, Entergy came to them and said, we want an exemption from fixing this, from retrofitting the faulty, defective fire wrap. And the NRC said, sure, no problem. So really, truly, between the entire 20 million people in the New York metropolitan area and a disastrous meltdown is 24-minute fire protection. So if there's an earthquake at Indian Point, besides the fact that the plant isn't designed to withstand anything above a 5.2 earthquake, or 5.4 I think it is, we have this really serious risk of a fire, and a fire that would affect the spent fuel pools and the reactor because we don't have proper insulation, fire protection.
Right, and that is the other huge risk revealed by the Fukushima meltdown in Japan. It's the stupendous amount of highly radioactive spent fuel stored on the site. What is the situation at Indian Point?
Well, right now, every drop of radioactive waste that has ever been produced at Indian Point is at Indian Point. And we're talking about 2,800 tons of high-level radioactive waste that's growing every single day. And it turns out that they're in these very densely packed spent fuel pools that are at least four times denser than they were designed to be. And it's acknowledged that spent fuel pool 2 at Indian Point, number 2, has a crack in it. And they know there's a crack in it, but they don't know where the crack is, and they've only inspected 40% of the pool because they say it's too hard to inspect because it's in bedrock. We know there's a crack there, and they know it's leaking into the Hudson River, strontium, cesium, and tritium. But the NRC has said, don't worry about it. It's okay. It's just leaking into the Hudson River. And so right now the spent fuel pools are so densely packed at Indian Point, and they started moving some of it into dry casks, but that's hardly enough to alleviate the densely packed spent fuel pools.
And so on 9/11, one of the hijacked jets flew pretty near that Indian Point site as it was heading to the World Trade Center. And the operators at Indian Point repeatedly claim their reactors can withstand a direct hit by aircraft. I doubt that. But Susan, are the spent fuel pools protected against such a terrorist attack?
Absolutely not. They are in buildings that are basically, they have a steel roof like a Walmart. They're totally not hardened sites. They're totally not protected. And the terrorists actually flew directly over Indian Point because where they're located on the Hudson River is one of the most navigable rivers in the world. It's a very, very straight tidal river. So at that point, it becomes very straight line. So for an amateur pilot, it wasn't hard for them to go straight down the Hudson. And they and what we have since learned since 9/11 is that the terrorists had originally considered hitting Indian Point, but decided not to, instead hit the World Trade Center.
But we don't really have to wait for a terrorist attack. Tell us about the fires, the accidents, the leaks, and the shutdowns at Indian Point.
Okay, so, you know, when I first got involved in this, it was right after 9/11. I had a little girl in preschool 3 miles from Indian Point, and that's why I got involved at first. And at first, we were all concerned about the terrorism. And what I realized is that it's not the terrorists that's the danger here. It's the actual old, corroded machinery at Indian Point that's the danger. The fact that it's the corroded, aged concrete and rebar steel with multiple miles of underground piping that has not been inspected, and really, really poor operations controls, and also security controls are very degraded at Indian Point. And, you know, the reality is Indian Point, when it was first sighted, the population in this area was 10 times less than it is today. And we don't have any evacuation routes out of our region. It's surrounded by a mountain range called the Rampo Mountains. They're not very high, but they are like what the Rockies, many, many millennia ago, they were like the Rockies. And so it's a range, and there's only a few passes and a few routes out. And so we're talking about, you know, 20 million people trying to escape this area. And it's just not a reality.
And it looks to me like the NRC is only requiring an evacuation plan for a 10-mile radius around Indian Point, and that's pretty strange considering the American government advised its citizens to pull back 50 miles from Fukushima during that accident. So what are they doing here with these emergency plans?
Well, we all know the emergency plans don't work, and in fact, New York State Governor Pataki spent almost $1 million, brought in an expert from FEMA, James Lee Witt, to evaluate whether the evacuation plans work. And he did a very extensive, thorough report and came back saying they don't work and they're not fixable. We do not have the road infrastructure. We do not have the transportation systems that could adequately get the people out of the area. And we also have, like, for example, when Sandy, the superstorm Sandy hit, what happened was we had a storm surge at Indian Point on the Hudson River, but they kept operating the plant. Now, everyone's power was down. There were trees down. People couldn't drive for 2 weeks, but they kept operating the plant until there was a hot shutdown, which is the most dangerous way to shut down a plant, highest risk of doing it. But the NRC's issue is let's keep the companies profitable at the risk of all these people's lives. They don't really take that into account, is what, you know, having spent many years now looking into this, that their issue is all profit, bottom line, dollars and cents to the corporation, and not, they don't look at the actual cost of what life would be if such a, you know, disaster would happen.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@eagleshock.org. That's radio@eagleshock.org.
You're tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is environmental lawyer Susan Hito Shapiro. She lives not far from the Indian Point nuclear reactor site, as we've heard. Well, now, Susan, I think the nuclear industry would claim that up to 30% of electricity for New York City is provided by the Indian Point reactors. Does New York City need to go dark if we finally shut down this plant?
That number, 30%, is totally inaccurate and false. They advertise, you know, 25-30%. That they supply to New York City. That's not true. It's a 2,000 megawatt reactor, and they only supply today 350 megawatts to Con Ed, which is the New York City electricity supplier. The rest are selling at the highest bidder on the open market. On top of the fallacy of the amount, by law, New York City can only receive, I think it's 18% of its power from outside the city. The rest of the power has to be produced within the boundaries of the city. So the reality of 25-30% is just false. The Public Service Commission has proven over and over again that that's not true. And the reality is, in the grid in New York State, we have plenty of capacity. Indian Point has been dark for extended periods of time, and there's never been a power problem in New York at all. There's a transmission problem, but there's not a power problem.
There's some odd supporters of this project to keep it going, and I found it strange that Reverend Al Sharpton turned up to support Indian Point. He said the alternative of natural gas plants would pollute the air worse for African Americans. Myself, I think African Americans might be the last people to be evacuated if Indian Point melts down, as they were in New Orleans after Katrina. What do you make of some of the opponents, or let's say the proponents of this project, the people who are supporting keeping it going?
Well, it's an interesting situation. What has happened is that Entergy has spent a lot of money in the African American community buying support. They've set up these fake front not-for-profit organizations, one's called New York Area. You can look at it. They acknowledge that they've set it up. And what they do is they actually bus in people who know nothing about the issue, who've been paid $10 and given a dinner or a lunch, and they carry signs, and they say, we don't want it because we're going to get asthma, because you're going to want to put more coal fire plants, you know, in my community. Well, that's totally false. I mean, we've done multiple studies, and it turns out in New York City alone, if you just put solar on all the buildings that are municipally owned buildings, you would have enough energy to power New York City. The anti-nuclear movement is not pro-fracking and pro-natural gas, nor pro-coal. We believe all dirty energy is not the solution. We have the technology and the knowledge today to move forward with a clean energy future. And it turns out that nuclear has been promoted and is being promoted right now by the federal EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, as a solution to coal, that as an emissions-free energy. Well, that happens to be one of the biggest fallacies of all. Nuclear is not emissions-free. It not only gives off radioactive byproducts constantly, all the time that it's operating, and it gives off thermal pollution, superheating the air and the water around nuclear plants at much higher rates than any other kind of energy. But it also gives off an enormous amount of carbon-14 and other carbon-based products and methane that is never calculated. And then when you look at the entire nuclear fuel cycle, its carbon footprint is comparable to a natural gas plant. And so it's a big fallacy that nuclear is emissions-free.
So have you found that there are certain health studies that show a high risk around this nuclear plant?
Yes, we did a study, an epidemiological study that you can find on radiation.org regarding thyroid cancer, because thyroid cancer is a marker for exposure to radiation. And it turns out around Indian Point, in the three counties surrounding Indian Point, the thyroid cancer rate is astronomically higher than the rest of the nation. In one county, it's 108% higher. Another is 76% higher. And we've also been monitoring. We've been doing citizen science monitoring. And shockingly, we were surprised that the radiation levels are actually, we can actually see when there are spikes doing our citizen science monitoring. And it's in the areas where the thyroid cancer is the highest.
And what's the position of the New York State governor?
Well, he has said he thinks Indian Point should be shut down. But recently we had a very disappointing ruling from the court that said that Indian Point does not need state approval because they can be grandfathered in, because they were cited, you know, in the 1970s before a lot of environmental laws were even on the books. However, we are still waiting on one really major possibility of shutting down this plant, and it's in the governor's hands, and we're trying to, the governor and the Department of Environmental Conservation's hands, is they ruled on 2010 that Indian Point could no longer use the Hudson River because it does not use closed cycle cooling, and that it's releasing radioactivity into the Hudson River. And that's been in an appeals. It's gone to the Supreme Court. It's come back down. They've ruled that they have to put in this closed-cycle cooling. Entergy's been fighting against it, and I think we're in the final round of appeals this spring, and we will see. We will see what happens. You know, I don't believe the battle's over yet, and I still think we have a very strong position on that issue. It's a Clean Water Act. They're in violation. They've been in violation since they began operation in the 1970s of the Clean Water Act.
So who are some of the citizen activist groups who are trying to get these two dangerous reactors closed down?
We have Hudson River Clearwater, which was Pete Seeger's, you know, founding organization, and River Keeper and Scenic Hudson. We all work together as a coalition called the Indian Point Safe Energy Coalition. You know, there are groups and individuals. When right after 9/11, we had 75 groups that had become part of the coalition. And, you know, no one's backed out at this point. They're still all members.
And what do these groups want done to provide more safety for the site?
There's multiple things. One is we want to have fire protection. We want proper fire insulation in the plant. We want to make sure the seismology is, you know, they build it correctly or retrofit it so that it can withstand the earthquakes that are in our region. We want to have the piping that's leaking fixed. We want the groundwater to be cleaned up. And one of the big lawsuits that's currently out there is a multi-billion dollar lawsuit by the security guards at Indian Point for failure of the security system, for multiple failures of the security system. And we don't believe that there's any security at Indian Point at this point. There's no no-fly zone over Indian Point. You can basically take a kayak and go right up to it. It's a very unsecured site.
Well, considering the terrorist problems that have cropped up in various parts of the world, that sounds pretty dumb. And you would think Wall Street might worry that they have to leave town permanently due to a nearby nuclear accident. After Fukushima, the Japanese seriously considered abandoning Tokyo, and some big companies did move out of that city. Let's look at the impossible. What would happen to New York City if a reactor or two at Indian Point suffered a catastrophic meltdown?
It would have to be evacuated permanently. In New York City is right within the line of the way the wind blows. It would absolutely have to be, the 20 million people in the region would have to be evacuated permanently. And I don't know, you know, I know you're in Canada. I don't know if you have the same kind of law called the Price-Anderson Act. But it turns out that under the federal government, that if there's a nuclear accident, there's a limit of liability by the nuclear owners to $12.2 billion. It turns out that the property values in this region are over $8.5 trillion. And if everyone looked at their homeowner's policy, at their insurance policy, there's a nuclear exclusion. And all businesses, any insurance, you cannot get insurance for a nuclear accident. Whether you're a business, a homeowner, it would basically bankrupt the United States if there was an accident at Indian Point. It has the highest density of any nuclear plant in the world around it.
Well, you'd say that could never happen, but then it happened at Fukushima, and they said it could never happen there either.
Yeah, it's one of those things. You know, they're betting. It's a gamble. That's Indian Point is one of the biggest gambles that, you know, the United States has continued to take and is continuing to take, and that's why we've been fighting to get it closed down, because we really see it as a gamble. And at the end of the day, even when it's closed, you're still going to have the waste there because there is no place to put nuclear waste. And there is absolutely no solution for what to do with nuclear waste anywhere in the world at this point. And, the idea of burial is there is no site on the planet that is safe to bury it without some sort of contamination to groundwater. And the amount of waste heat that's produced from nuclear waste continues on and on for millennia, as well as the radiation.
Once you start it, it's never really over, but at least it could be a lot safer than it is. If those reactors weren't working, they could start the process of decommissioning. Even if it takes a couple of generations, they could make it better.
I agree with that. One of the other sides of the problem is that there's no funding. The decommissioning funds are not adequate to actually do proper decommissioning. And the other thing you asked, what we want, the nuclear fuel out of the spent fuel pools and put into dry cast hardened storage. Right now, the way they're even putting the dry cast at Indian Point is not hardened. They're on flat, like, concrete pads, not bolted down, and not in the quality dry cast storage. They're in Holtec casts, which are one of the lowest and worst rated, and around the world they don't use them. In other countries, in Germany and in France, they don't even use them because they're so poorly designed.
So can you give us some websites or social media places so that our listeners can follow up on this?
Sure. You can go to IPSECinfo.org. You can go to radiation.org, which is Radiation Public Health project that has a lot of epidemiological and health studies on that site, riverkeeper.org, clearwater.org, and each one of those has a link to their Indian Point campaign.
We've been talking with environmental lawyer and longtime nuclear critic and activist Susan Hito Shapiro. You can find links to those local action groups and news about this awful reactor in my Radio EcoShock blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Susan, I want to thank you not just for talking with us, but also I found out you've been spending years and years trying to defend the public against this nuclear threat.
Yeah, it's an uphill battle, but you know, there's a group of us that are very dedicated to trying to at least open the public's eyes. You know, that's the biggest problem we have in New York City. The majority of people don't even know that they're 25 miles from this, you know, very dangerous reactor system.
Well, maybe a few of them will hear this program. We can hope for that. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Get this program and all our past shows as free MP3 downloads from our website at ecoshock.org or visit the Radio EcoShock SoundCloud page to listen in. I'll have links to lots of things we talked about this week in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. Here's my buddy Dana Pearson, known as Vast Mandana on SoundClick, with his new creation, The Engines of Life.
Well, I know. It's gonna be hard for you to understand. But the world is happening, man, and it's not gonna go away any sooner. And everything we do, and everything we say, and every step we take, and every action we take, when the wind dries down, it's gonna send us into some place, cause everything's so unstable. We have thrown so many monkey wrenches